Chapter 24. Coal hole. That was what I did, why Aaron? For I was that silly, why the youngest lad, as I could never bear to smack him. Not as I could find I my heart, to let him stay I the coal hole more nor a minute, but it was enough to coaly him all over, so as he must be new washed and dressed, and it was as good as a rod to him that was. But I put it you o your conscience, Master Marner, as there's one of 'em, you must choose aether smacking, or the coal hole else she'll get so masterful, there'll be no holding her. Silas was impressed with the melancholy truth of this last remark, but his force of mind failed before the only two penal methods open to him, not only because it was painful to him to hurt Eppie, but because he trembled at a moment's contention with her, lest she should love him the less for it. Let even an affectionate Goliath get himself tied to a small tender thing, dreading to hurt it by pulling, and dreading still more to snap the cord, and which of the two, pray, will be master? It was clear that Eppie, with her short toddling steps, must lead Father Silas a pretty dance on any fine morning when circumstances favored mischief. For example, he had wisely chosen a broad strip of linen as a means of fastening her to his loom when he was busy. It made a broad belt round her waist, and was long enough to allow of her reaching the truckle bed and sitting down on it, but not long enough for her to attempt any dangerous climbing. One bright summer's morning Silas had been more engrossed than usual in heading up a new piece of work, an occasion on which his scissors were in requisition. These scissors, owing to an especial warning of Dolly's, had been kept carefully out of Eppie's reach, but the click of them had had a peculiar attraction for her ear, and watching the results of that click, as he had derived the philosophic lesson that the same cause would produce the same effect. Silas had seated himself in his loom, and the noise of weaving had begun, but he had left his scissors on a ledge which Eppie's arm was long enough to reach, and now, like a small mouse, watching her opportunity, she stole quietly from her corner, secured the scissors, and toddled to the bed again, setting up her back as a mode of concealing the fact. As he had a distinct intention as to the use of the scissors, and having cut the linen strip in a jagged but effectual manner, in 2 moments as he had run out at the open door, where the sunshine was invading her, while poor Silas believed her to be a better child than usual. It was not until he happened to need his scissors, that the terrible fact burst upon him. Eppie had run out by herself, had perhaps fallen into the stone pit. Silas, shaken by the worst fear that could have befallen him, rushed out, calling Pie, and ran eagerly about the unenclosed space, exploring the dry cavities into which he might have fallen, and then gazing with questioning dread at the smooth red surface of the water. The cold drops stood on his brow. How long had she been out? There was one hope, that as he had crept through the stile, and got into the fields, where he habitually took her to stroll. But the grass was high in the meadow, and there was no descrying her, if she were there, except by a close search that would be a trespass on Mr. Osgood's crop. Still, that misdemeanor must be committed. And poor Silas, after peering all round the hedgerows, traversed the grass, beginning with perturbed vision, to see Eppie behind every group of red sorrel, and to see her moving always farther off as he approached. The meadow was searched in vain, and he got over the stile into the next field, looking with dying hope towards a small pond which was now reduced to its summer shallowness, so as to leave a wide margin of good adhesive mud. Here, however, sat Eppie, discoursing cheerfully to her own small boot, which she was using as a bucket, to convey the water into a deep hoof mark, while her little naked foot was planted comfortably on a cushion of olive-green mud. A red-headed calf was observing her with alarm out through the opposite hedge. Here was clearly a case of aberration in a christened child which demanded severe treatment. But Silas, overcome with convulsive joy at finding his treasure again, could do nothing but snatch her up, and cover her with half-sobbing kisses. It was not until he had carried her home, and had begun to think of the necessary washing, that he recollected the need that he should punish Eppie, and make her remember. The idea that she might run away again and come to harm gave him unusual resolution, and for the first time he determined to try the coal hole, a small closet near the hearth. "Naughty, naughty Eppy," he suddenly began, holding her on his knee and pointing to her muddy feet and clothes, "naughty to cut with the scissors and run away. Eppy must go into the coal hole for being naughty. Daddy must put her in the coal hole." He half expected that this would be shock enough, and that Eppy would begin to cry. But instead of that, she began to shake herself on his knee, as if the proposition opened a pleasing novelty. Seeing that he must proceed to extremities, he put her into the coal hole, and held the door closed, with a trembling sense that he was using a strong measure. For a moment there was silence, but then came a little cry, "Opie, Opie!" And Silas let her out again, saying, "Now Eppy'll never be naughty again, else she must go in the coal hole, a black naughty place. The weaving must stand still a long while this morning, for now Eppy must be washed, and have clean clothes on." But it was to be hoped that this punishment would have a lasting effect, and save time in future, though, perhaps, it would have been better if Eppy had cried more. In half an hour she was clean again, and Silas, having turned his back to see what he could do with the linen band, threw it down again, with the reflection that Eppy would be good without fastening for the rest of the morning. He turned round again, and was going to place her in her little chair near the loom, when she peeped out at him with black face and hands again, and said, "Eppy in the coal hole." This total failure of the coal hole discipline shook Silas's belief in the efficacy of punishment. "He'd take it all for fun," he observed to Dolly, "if I didn't hurt her, and that I can't do, Mrs. Winthrop. If she makes me a bit o' trouble, I can bear it. And she's got no tricks, but what she'll grow out of." "Well, that's partly true, Master Marner," said Dolly, sympathetically. "And if you can't bring your mind to frighten her off touching things, you must do what you can to keep 'em out of her way. That's what I do why the pups as the lads are lazy-rearing. They will worry, and gnaw they will, if it was one Sunday cap as hung anywhere so as they could drag it. They know no difference, God help 'em. It's the pushing o' the teeth as sets 'em on, that's what it is." So Eppy was reared without punishment, the burden of her misdeeds being borne vicariously by Father Silas. The stone hut was made a soft nest for her, lined with downy patience. And also in the world that lay beyond the stone hut she knew nothing of frowns and denials. Notwithstanding the difficulty of carrying her and his yarn or linen at the same time, Silas took her with him in most of his journeys to the farmhouses, unwilling to leave her behind at Dolly Winthrop's, who was always ready to take care of her, and little curly-headed Eppy, the weaver's child, became an object of interest at several outlying homesteads, as well as in the village. Hitherto he had been treated very much as if he had been a useful gnome, or brownie, a queer and unaccountable creature, who must necessarily be looked at with wondering curiosity and repulsion, and with whom one would be glad to make all greetings and bargains as brief as possible, but who must be dealt with in a propitiatory way, and occasionally have a present of pork or garden stuff to carry home with him, seeing that without him there was no getting the yarn woven. But now Silas met with open smiling faces and cheerful questioning, as a person whose satisfactions and difficulties could be understood. Everywhere he must sit a little and talk about the child, and words of interest were always ready for him, "Colin, ah, Master Marner, you'll be lucky if she takes the measles soon and easy." Or, "Why, there isn't many lone men I'd have been wishing to take up with a little un like that. But I reckon the weaving makes you handier than men as do outdoor work. You're partly as handy as a woman, for weaving comes next to spinning." Elderly masters and mistresses, seated observantly in large kitchen armchairs, shook their heads over the difficulties attendant on rearing children, felt Epi's round arms and legs, and pronounced them remarkably firm, and told Silas that, if she turned out well, which, however, there was no telling, it would be a fine thing for him to have a steady lass to do for him when he got helpless. Servant maidens were fond of carrying her out to look at the hens and chickens, or to see if any cherries could be shaken down in the orchard. And the small boys and girls approached her slowly, with cautious movement and steady gaze, like little dogs face to face with one of their own kind, till attraction had reached the point at which the soft lips were put out for a kiss. No child was afraid of approaching Silas when Epi was near him. There was no repulsion around him now, either for young or old, for the little child had come to link him once more with the whole world. There was love between him and the child that blent them into one, and there was love between the child and the world from men and women with parental looks and tones, to the red lady birds and the round pebbles. Silas began now to think of Ravelo life entirely in relation to Epi. She must have everything that was a good in Ravelo, and he listened docilely, that he might come to understand better what this life was, from which, for 15 years, he had stood aloof, as from a strange thing, with which he could have no communion. As some man who has a precious plant to which he would give a nurturing home in a new soil, thinks of the rain, and the sunshine, and all influences, in relation to his nursling, and asks industriously for all knowledge that will help him to satisfy the wants of the searching roots, or to guard leaf and bud from invading harm. The disposition to hoard had been utterly crushed at the very first by the loss of his long-stored gold. The coins he earned afterward seemed as irrelevant as stones brought to complete a house suddenly buried by an earthquake. The sense of bereavement was too heavy upon him for the old thrill of satisfaction to arise again at the touch of the newly earned coin. And now something had come to replace his hoard, which gave a growing purpose to the earnings, drawing his hope and joy continually onward beyond the money. In old days there were angels who came and took men by the hand, and led them away from the city of destruction. We see no white-winged angels now. But yet men are led away from threatening destruction. A hand is put into theirs, which leads them forth gently towards a calm and bright land, so that they look no more backward. And the hand may be a little child's. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.